WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In his new book about South Africa, journalist David Goodman writes, "In the years since the end of white minority rule, everything has changed, and nothing has changed." He elaborates on that in a series of profiles of people who straddle the great divides of South African society, rich and poor, famous and obscure, powerful and weak, white and black. Goodman first went to South Africa in 1984. He's written for The Nation, Mother Jones, and the Boston Globe. His new book is called Fault Lines, Journeys into the New South Africa. South Africa will be holding national elections this spring to replace Nelson Mandela, who became president in 1994. I asked Goodman for his evaluation of Mandela's presidency.
You might say that reconciliation became the civil religion under Mandela. Indeed, he took every opportunity to preach it both in his personal and political life, going to visit the wife of the former prime minister who imprisoned him back in the early 60s. This was shortly after he became president. And even a time when I accompanied him, when he returned to the jail where he spent the last 3 years of his 27-year incarceration, and he met with the warder, the prison guard, who in many ways was more a servant and a cook than a conventional jailer. So I would say that Mandela has done a remarkable job at keeping his country together and doing something that no one thought possible in South Africa, which was keeping it from boiling over into war. Mandela's successor is most likely to be a man named Thabo Mbeki, his deputy. And I think Mbeki will have a much more difficult job. Mandela was something of a saint. Mbeki is a mere politician and will suffer the consequences that often go with politicians trying to bring people together.
So assuming Mbeki does become the next president, what kind of president do you think he might be?
Mandela has both a large domestic following, popular following in South Africa. He's enormously popular, and an international following where he's viewed as one of the preeminent world statesmen. Mbeki does not have that kind of popularity. He was in exile during the African National Congress's decades-long liberation struggle against the white minority government. And as such, he has not cultivated the personal following or the moral stature that Mandela has. One of the things that I saw in touring South Africa was the enormous amount of poverty that remains, and it is a legacy of apartheid that the new government has really been unable to eradicate. I think Mbeki will be held sharply accountable for those shortcomings of the society.
Well, do you think the new government has been unable to eradicate poverty because it's so entrenched or because the government has not followed through on what it promised to?
I think that Nelson Mandela and the ANC back in 94, when they were campaigning for election, made some very lofty promises that they were simply unable to keep. They spoke of things like a million houses by the next election, which is coming this June. They've built about a quarter of those. They may have simply aimed too high. They've also chosen a rather conservative economic course that has greatly pleased institutions like the World Bank and the IMF, but have left many township activists, the people who once supported the ANC, furious. One of the people who I profile in my book is a woman named Adelaide Busso. Adelaide is really emblematic of the dilemma that South Africa finds herself in. She is a domestic worker, a squatter who lives in a metal shack outside Cape Town. She also now sits, is a councillor on the city council for one of the wealthiest communities in South Africa. Indeed, it's the community where she cleans floors and toilets still. So in Adelaide, we have the figure of a woman who has attained political power but still has no economic power. And that is very much the situation that many blacks find themselves in today in South Africa.
You also say that there's a new black elite. It's a small group, but it's a growing group. And you profile somebody who's a member of this group. She heads a cleaning service and drives, I think, a Mercedes.
Yes, Tumi Madise was a fascinating person to follow around. She runs what has now become the largest firm of domestic workers in South Africa. I call her the apartheid jiu-jitsu artist because she has been totally unapologetic in turning apartheid on its head. The way that she's done that, as she explained to me, was to assess very coldly and unsentimentally where people are coming from. She grew up in Soweto, was kind of a tough street-fighting kid, and has still maintained those qualities. So what she told me was that the white English-speaking South Africans are very racist, and they think that blacks can only clean toilets. And she said, "I tell them, I'll clean your toilets, but you're going to pay me a lot of money to do it."
You profile several people in your new book, Fault Lines. One of them is Paul Erasmus, a former member of the security branch of the South African police, and this was the branch that went after dissidents and often tortured them. One of his victims, someone who he was involved in the assassination attempt of, is a minister who was tortured for several weeks for refusing to name the names of communists. Tell us more about why this minister was the target.
In the late 1970s, Frank Chikane was a pastor of a black church in a small black township outside of Johannesburg called Kagiso. He came to this community in 1976, which was a very fateful year in South Africa. It was the year of what has now become known as the Soweto riots, a watershed uprising of blacks against apartheid. All of a sudden, Frank Chikane found himself in what amounted to a war situation where his congregants were being rounded up and thrown into jail. And he intervened at the request of his congregants. And he very rapidly rose through the ranks as a very eloquent and forceful defender of the rights of black people, both in his congregation and beyond. Chikane became the head of the South African Council of Churches in the late 1980s. As a result of his efforts, Chikane endured 3 rounds of torture, 6 rounds of detention, a year of hiding, and ultimately, in 1989, an assassination attempt where his clothes were mysteriously poisoned. He actually fell ill in the United States. He had come on a high-level church delegation with Archbishop Tutu and others to meet with President Bush, and he fell ill, and it was here that it was discovered that he had been poisoned.
Paul Erasmus, the member of the South African police who was involved in the assassination attempt of Chikane, Erasmus went public to the Goldstone Commission. This was the commission that was investigating state-sponsored violence in South Africa. Why did he go public and confess to some of the acts of torture, etc., that he committed?
Paul Erasmus was a member, as you said, of the secret police. He had a falling out with his superiors. Basically, he had was centrally involved in attacking anyone deemed to be a anti-apartheid activist, and finally found the strain of the work that he was doing, which involved often going around at night, firebombing people's homes, and in the case of Reverend Chikane, being involved in scoping his house out. And then Erasmus's partner later returned, according to Erasmus, to do the actual poisoning of Chikane's clothes. Erasmus had asked for was suffering from a variety of symptoms related to stress. He wasn't able to sleep. He has a son with cerebral palsy, and so he was moved to another police station outside of Johannesburg. He thought it would be a low-stress job. Instead, he got into a big fight with his boss. The result was he was frozen out. His money was kept from him. His house was seized. And so as Erasmus told me, when the police turned on him, he turned on the police. And he then went to the Goldstone Commission in 1994 on the eve of the elections that brought Mandela to power and told everything that he knew about this, the former white government's involvement in state-sponsored terrorism.
Paul Erasmus, the cop, and Reverend Chikane, who was nearly assassinated, had something of a reconciliation. Tell us about that.
Well, Paul Erasmus is quite haunted by many of the things he did. So in 1995, he called Reverend Chikane. Reverend Chikane is now the top aide to Thabo Mbeki, the man who will likely become president in June. And he called to say that he was sorry for what he did. He had actually hoped to meet with Chikane, but Chikane replied through an intermediary with a very pointed question. Will you tell me who actually poisoned my clothes? Because Erasmus has maintained, well, he didn't actually put the poison in. That was his partner. Erasmus said no. His partner would have to come forward on his own. He didn't want to rat on his old friend. And so Chikane said simply that he would agree to speak to him on the phone. Well, when the phone call finally came, Erasmus described to me how nervous he was. He was afraid that, like many of the people that he once terrorized, that Chikane would upbraid him and berate him for the things he did. Instead, Erasmus was dumbstruck when Chikane asked how his family was doing and then said that he forgave him.
You've reported on the work of the Truth Commission, and you talked to Chikane about how he felt about the Truth Commission, and the near reconciliation that you just mentioned is very related to it, because Erasmus went public about his deeds. He's not going to be prosecuted for what he's done, and he's been given some amount of forgiveness by one of his victims. What did Chikane, the victim, have to say about the Truth Commission?
Well, Chikane is in an awkward position. He's a political leader in South Africa and was among those who advocated having some kind of truth commission in lieu of Nuremberg-style trials. And yet, in his own personal life, he has found it very difficult to forgive not the foot soldiers like Paul Erasmus. He told me that he understands the foot soldiers. At one point he said, you know, I know what these guys went through. They were taken at age 18. They were put into the army, as every South African white male had to serve in the army. And they were told that we were the enemy. We were there to tear down their homes and blow up their businesses. So he said, I understand they fought with their heart and soul. He said, but it's the leaders, the F.W. de Klerks, the P.W. Botas. These are the former presidents. He said, those men are profiting from our misery. And to this day, they draw double pensions for the suffering that they inflicted on our people. He said, those people I've not forgiven yet.
What were your personal impressions of Paul Erasmus?
Well, when I met Erasmus, it was real cloak and dagger stuff, just arranging a meeting with him. There have been two assassination attempts on Erasmus's life by his former police colleagues because he has revealed the various nefarious things that the former government did. And so when I came to meet him, it was I was to come to a certain town, call from a payphone, and then meet him at a meeting place that we had, a neutral meeting place. I was not allowed to see his home, his family, his wife. My impressions on meeting him were that he still, he's a very complex character. He still has some of the swagger of his old days and a bit of pride in having been, in his own mind, a good cop, although being a good cop just also happened to make you a terrible and morally bankrupt person, as he would probably acknowledge. Probably the most vivid image that I have of him came when we were about to leave. We spent about 12 hours together, and it was at his insistence that we just do this in a long sitting where he just told his whole story of killing and firebombing and harassing. And we walked outside, and it was about midnight, and we stood next to his car, and there was a kind of a crescent moon out, and Paul was very agitated and nervous, and he said to me, maybe I've wasted my life, he said, and I saw that he was fidgeting, and I couldn't help but say to him that, are you spooked being out here? And just then there was a loud firecracker crack in the distance, and he flinched and wheeled around. Of course, there was nothing there. And he said, yeah, well, he says, it's part of my condition now, my post-traumatic stress. And then some kids were walking up the block, and they looked fairly innocuous to me. One was wearing a hooded sweatshirt, but he could not take his eyes off them. He had become quite paranoid. And it struck me that the night had turned on him, and the night was where he did his best work. But now he's haunted and lives on the run. And I guess the overall image I had was of the power of one's conscience to haunt you for many years to come, long after the bad deeds that you've committed.
My guest is David Goodman, author of Fault Lines, Journeys into the New South Africa. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist David Goodman, author of Fault Lines, Journeys into the New South Africa. Now, you mentioned that Reverend Frank Chikane, a minister who was tortured by the South African police, and there was also an assassination attempt on his life, that he was willing to forgive the foot soldiers, the police, but he wasn't willing to forgive the people who ordered them to assassinate and who ordered them to torture. And he wasn't able to forgive the former white presidents who ruled over apartheid. You actually paid a visit to one of those former presidents, P.W. Botha, who was in power from 77 to 89. He's not somebody who gives interviews. How did you manage to talk with him?
Well, it's well known to journalists that P.W. Botha doesn't talk. Didn't talk then in the 80s and doesn't talk now. He was the strong man of apartheid. And throughout the 1980s, it's fair to say he was probably the most hated man in Africa. He was singularly identified with the finger-wagging, scolding, kind of belligerent attitude of the white government. I met Botha by accident. I was in South Africa with my family, my wife and my daughter, who was then 4 years old, and we had set off from Cape Town for a month-long trip around the country. Well, one day out of Cape Town, my 14-year-old car that I had just bought blew its transmission, and we limped into a small town called George, where I promptly deposited the car at an auto repair shop and had to figure out what to do for 3 days. Well, the only thing I knew about George was that it was the home to P.W. Botha. And so I went to a museum where they had a P.W. Botha wing, and I asked them, could I speak to Mr. Botha? And they naturally laughed and said no, but they said they'd give him a call. One thing led to another, and P.W. Botha got on the phone and explained to me that, no, of course he wouldn't see me. He doesn't speak to journalists and doesn't do this kind of thing, and journalists have caused him nothing but misery in his life. But I pointed out that I was 10 minutes away from his house. That gave him a little pause. And finally, he relented and said, okay, you can come over tomorrow. We'll speak for 30 minutes and no politics. The next day, I came over as told. I found P.W. Botha when I came in, and instantly we talked for 3 hours and about nothing but politics. And I then returned to see him several months later to pay him another visit. He is as belligerent and irascible as ever. Totally unapologetic and unrepentant for what happened during the years of apartheid rule. An interesting footnote to all this is that Nelson Mandela has visited Botha three times, once when he was in prison, but then twice since he's become president. And it struck me as I left Botha, and it was an incredibly bizarre experience for me to meet the man behind the legend. It struck me that there are actually similarities between Botha and Mandela.
What are some of the similarities that you see?
Well, both are men of principle who have stuck to their principles, perhaps to a fault and to great personal sacrifice. Mandela, in his case, it cost him over 2 decades, nearly 3 decades in prison. And Botha, it ended up forcing him from the presidency in 1989. Their moral stature cannot be compared, but some of their personality traits, and indeed they apparently get along fairly well, there certainly are those things that one sees that both of them shares.
You mentioned that you had once accompanied Nelson Mandela on a trip back to his former prison. What did you learn about Nelson Mandela on that trip?
I accompanied Mandela along with a small group of journalists and an entourage of prison officials, actually. It was a very unusual visit, into the place where he was last in jail. It was actually a small cottage on the grounds of this prison, which was set in this bucolic setting out in the wine country, kind of like the Napa Valley of South Africa. And it was there that Mandela turned to me and said, "These were the best years of my life," he said as he walked into this. And I looked at him rather shocked and said, "But you were a prisoner here." And he said, "Yes, but this is where I first met the new leadership, the young leadership of the African National Congress, the people who are going to lead the country now. And we first began to share views on what South Africa after apartheid would look like. It was also quite touching because it was the place where he was then reunited with the man who was his jailer. This fellow named Brigadier Swart was a tall, thin, middle-aged Afrikaner man. He was Mandela turned at one point and said, "What has become of him?" And the prison official said, "Well, he's standing outside." And so in walks this very nervous-looking man in a suit, and Mandela turned to him and held his hand, as he often does, and looked him in the eye and said, "I will never forget the kindness that you and your family showed me while I was here." In fact, Swart often would bring Mandela home, and his wife would cook him meals. And Swart became very teary-eyed, and then Mandela sort of broke the tension around it by then asking him about his children and whatnot. But it was and has been Mandela's ability to cross political divides and touch people's hearts that I think has made him such a remarkable leader and such an icon of reconciliation there.
Well, David Goodman, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you, Terry.
David Goodman is the author of Fault Lines, Journeys into the New South Africa. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.